Everyone is more than welcome to the Parsha class on Vayishlach this year, 5765. And Vayishlach is the story, one of the episodes of the life of Yaakov Avinu. Of all of the Ovos, we have a lot in the Torah about Yaakov Avinu. And usually, even as we study from the comments of Rav Yerucham Levavitz, the revered Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual leader of the Mir Yeshiva in Poland, and although he does make separate commentaries on different pesukim throughout the Parsha, but we have attempted to try to distill from it a certain theme, which we always try to do. In this week's Parsha, Vayishlach, I couldn't do that. I couldn't find any central theme, because every comment seems to be so different, one from the other, and about a different topic or insight. What binds it all together is that this is the life of Yaakov Avinu. And imagine if we were able to watch Yaakov in action and look at every move he made, and either by deducing it ourselves or by having him explain why he did what he did, we were able to get a slight glimpse as to what went on inside that monumental giant, that father of ours, a spiritual father of the world. Just imagine what that would be like. So, if you will with me today, just go on a tour of the parshios of the psukim, one by one, the ones that are highlighted by Rav Lubavitz, and just read the verse, sometimes the Rashi that accompanies it, and just try to get a glimpse into the mindset of Yaakov Avinu, and the tremendous each pasuk giving us a foundational principle on how we are to live and think as Jews. We're going to start off with Vayishlach chapter 32, verse 4. The parsha opens up with Yaakov on his way back to Eretz Yisrael after 20 years away from Israel, away from his father, on the run from his brother Esav, and while away meeting his two wives, Rachel and Leah, and having quite kind of elongated business relationship with his father-in-law, Lavan, which was not a very smooth one, a very honest one on the part of the employer. But yes, on the part of the employee. Anyways, he prepares now, and he hears that Esav still remembers him, and he's coming out to greet him with 400 men. And Yaakov is going to have to face his brother after all these years. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanov el Esav achiv arza seir sedei edom. Then Yaakov sent angels ahead of him to Esav, his brother, to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. Vayetzav osam lemor kosom run ladoni leesav. He charged them, saying, thus shall you say to my lord Esav, ko amar avdecho Yaakov. So said your servant Yaakov, im lavan garti voechar ad ata. I have sojourned with Lavan and have lingered until now. Yaakov instructed the angels to use those terms. Esav is the lord, the master. Yaakov is the servant. Rashi doesn't comment on this, but Yerucham cites various midrashim that are very critical of the way Yaakov lowered himself. And it's a fine line. And another occasion we spoke, I think it was last year, we spoke about the fine line that a person has to play between proper diplomacy even with antagonistic people on the one hand, but on the other hand, not lowering ourselves as Jews. And Rav Yerucham expounds on this principle. He says that a Jew has to live for Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name. It's a term that we have referred to in the past. Kiddush Hashem. The glory of God fills the world. Melo chol ha'aretz kivodo. It says in Pirkei Avos, God says, everything that I created in the world was ultimately lichvodi, to demonstrate, to testify to the glory and the existence of God. But we also know that the only way that it does that is if people recognize it. God's glory can fill the world, but if nobody gives a hoot and if nobody acknowledges that, then it's not. Then the world is bereft of the presence of God. Who has the obligation or who has the wherewithal to sanctify God's name the best of all walks of humanity? Am Yisrael, the nation of Israel. Because we were given the Torah, we were spoken to by God at Har Sinai, and we were charged with the role of bringing God's presence to the knowledge and awareness of the people of the world. Therefore, it is incumbent upon a Jew to, in every move he makes, to make sure that he is campaigning for, that he is pushing, that he is endorsing the existence of God. If you have two personalities like Yaakov and Esav, Yaakov standing for Kedusha, for sanctity, for holiness, for godliness, and you have a person like Esav who says explicitly, what do I need to be the firstborn? What do I need to carry the spiritual burden? I'd rather have some lentil soup, because that's all that I really care about, is having immediate gratification right now, right? Which individual is proclaiming the name of God, and which one isn't? Clearly, Yaakov carries the name of God, and Esav is the opposite. So, for Yaakov, even in the name of diplomacy, for him to say, I'm the servant, you're the master, is really saying that your view of the world is also valid, maybe even in some way superior to mine. Maybe it's not essential that we live a life of kedusha, of sanctity, that we devote ourselves to God. It's okay to be a person like yourself, who has disconnected himself from God. Esav had an opportunity in Yitzchak's plan to maybe support Yaakov and to be a partner, but that was a nice dream. It wasn't to be reality. So in the meantime, Esav stands for everything anti-God. Materialism is the way of life. And for Yaakov to say, you are the master in any sense, diplomacy or not, is a breakdown of Yaakov's ultimate charge and the charge of a Jew. So Rav Yerucham tells us that this is a lesson number one from Yaakov. In this case, maybe something that Yaakov had better not have said. But the lesson here is that a Jew has to live constant awareness in all of his dealings and all of his encounters that we're not here for ourselves. We are here l'chvod koneinu, for the glory and the honor of our Creator. Okay, I will take a comment at this point. Thank you. Jeffrey.
How long after Yitzchak blessed Yaakov
did he die? He blessed Yaakov at the age of 123, and he died at the age of 180. He was the longest living of any of the patriarchs. So it was 57 years later. And therefore, he still lived to see Yaakov's return. Yaakov was gone for 20, and then an additional 14 years. He was studying, so 34 years. So he was still resumed.
He wants to see some of his grandchildren.
Yes, yes. All of his, yeah, all of his grandchildren. Yeah, Ron.
I see the pasuk where Yitzchak gives him the bracha that if ever Yaakov aggravates his brother,
yeah,
so to speak, then he will be, the tide will be turned, the brother will be high and he will be low.
That's in Parshas Toldos.
Right.
Yeah.
So I see now he comes back and he knows that Esau's bothered. He knows that he aggravated him, even though it was meant to be he gets the birthright. And so he's basically saying to him kind of the truth. He's saying to him in terms of this point, I know you're upset with me. I know that you think you were wronged in some of, in some of your logic, so I am your servant, and you are the master at this point. But, you know, maybe the tide will turn one day, and we will be reversed, where you will feel that you aggravated me, and I will be the master, and you will be the servant.
But in what way was did Esau feel that he was wronged in terms of the up and down? The up and down was said that if Yaakov will fall spiritually, then Esau will be empowered. In fact, Rashi points out that when Yaakov came back, he said, so says your servant Yaakov, im Lavan garti, I sojourned with Lavan. Rashi over there says, garti, I sojourned, has the same letters as Taryag, which are the 613 mitzvahs. And one explanation is, I heard, was he's saying, be careful, Esau, because I am fully adherent to the commandments, even though I lived with Lavan all these years, and therefore you don't have power over me.
Mm-hmm. Right, he did the mitzvahs when he was away.
Yeah.
But I was going back to here, it says, where you have been, where by your sword you shall live, but your brother you shall serve, yet it shall be that when you are aggrieved, you may cast off his yoke from
upon. But with that, we'll look at Rashi there. Rashi says, means when you're aggrieved, if Yaakov ever lowers himself spiritually, then you will be able to turn to Yitzchak and you'll be able to say, the whole reason why he got the blessing and not me is because he lives a life of sanctity and I don't. If he's not living up to his spiritual calling, then why should I be less? And Yitzchak says, well, said, if that's the case, then in fact, Esav, you have a good voice. Yaakov is reminding him that as of yet, that has not happened. That explains why the Jewish people are vulnerable most in times of spiritual decline. Because at that point we actually give power to Esav and to his cause. Okay, we move on, and Yaakov prepares for the encounter in several ways. Besides sending his messengers, he also sends forward gifts. You'll see on page 173. A whole, it's called the tribute, a whole slew of animals as offerings to Esau. He also prays to God, as actually earlier, the top of page 173, and military preparations. Yaakov, the sages tell us that Yaakov prepared himself in three ways. One of the things that it says is, verse 8, Vayirah Yaakov me'od, Vayetzer lo. Yaakov became very frightened, and it distressed him. Now, why would Yaakov become frightened? Certainly, he trusts in God. He trusts that God had promised him that he will return him to his father's home in peace. Why was he so frightened? So, Rashi, later on, he explains why he's afraid. In verse 11, he says, I have been diminished by all the kindnesses and by all the truth that you have done your servant. For with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I become two camps. Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother. So Rashi says, I'm unworthy of all the kindness, meaning my merits have diminished, this is Rashi, because of the kindnesses and truth that you have done with me. I'm afraid for the following reason, lest from the time you made me the promises, I have become tainted by sin, which will cause me to be delivered into Esau's hand. I know you promised me that you will protect me, but maybe since the time of that promise, maybe at the time of that promise I was worthy, and since that time I have become unworthy because of my sins. Okay, you and I have been learning this. We haven't encountered too many sins that Yaakov has done. You know, if anything, Yaakov has kept the Torah. If anything, Yaakov has maintained his truth even in the face of an evil employer and father-in-law and an entire surrounding environment, society. He had remained steadfast. He just said to Esav, I kept all the 613 commandments. Why is he afraid of his sin? This is revealing, says Rabbi Yerucham, of the nature of the tzaddikim, the great level of the tzaddikim, of the righteous men and women of our Torah. That what you and I consider a sin is not what they consider a sin. You know, to us a sin is something gross, something extreme, like murder, an immoral act. Not to the righteous men and women of our Torah. To them, an improper thought or an action with an improper, less than 100% pure motive is considered a sin. We see this throughout the Tanakh, and we discussed this once last year, that when the Torah says so-and-so sinned, it's not in our context of sin. It's in their context of sin. And it's in God's context, because God sees the hearts of everyone. When it says, for example, after Rachel Imenu died, so Reuven had, stuck up for his mother's honor, because Yaakov had spent more time with Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah, even less than Leah. And true, when Rachel was alive, he favored her over Leah slightly. But when Rachel died, you would think that he would give greater attention to Leah now. And yet he still maintains somewhat of a compassion with Rachel, with Bilhah, Rachel's maid. And so Reuven, for the sake of sticking up for his mother's honor, totally pure intention, made some type of a shift of the furniture, or a suggestive positioning of the bed. Well, what does the Torah say that Reuven did? Mm-hmm. Torah says that Reuven went and he slept with his father's concubine. He slept with his father's concubine. Could it be such a thing? Reuven, one of the tribes? And the sages say, no, he didn't really sleep with his concubine. But for someone of his stature to do what he did, even though he had the greatest intention, is tantamount for another person to take somebody's wife. Just to meddle into affairs by making a suggestion or making a comment, for that type of a person on his level is tantamount to adultery. This is how the Torah speaks. We can go on and on this subject. The Torah speaks from the perspective of these great righteous people. And therefore, when it says Yaakov was afraid, and Rashi elaborates and says, I've become tainted by sin. Tainted by sin is not what we think of as tainted by sin. Right, that he went out to nightclubs and he was gambling, right? It means that maybe he had some improper thoughts. Maybe for a moment, maybe once when he was sitting there with Lavan, he thought about perhaps being a little bit fighting fire with fire. Lavan's a little bit dishonest with me. I'll be a little bit lax with my dealings with him. For Yaakov, that would be already a terrible, gross sin. Or something else, or maybe for a moment he I don't even want to suggest anything, but that's what it means. I become tainted, niskal kalti. I have broken down to the extent that I'm no longer perhaps worthy of God's promises to me. Throughout the Torah, we have to realize who we're dealing with, and never to look at these stories in the Chumash like we would, God forbid, a soap opera. This is the standard of the Torah. Okay. We mentioned that that Yaakov prepared himself in three ways. Rashi says on the verse 9, Yaakov prepared himself for three things: for the giving of a gift, for prayer, and for war. For the giving of a gift, as it says in verse 22, the present passed on ahead of him, that was the animals. For prayer, as it says, the God of my father Abraham, that's in verse 10. And for war, as it says, the remaining camp will survive. So, it's different. The Rashi is on the verse 9, but Rashi is referring to Psukim in different places. So so what is this idea? Rav Yerucham speaks about Yaakov here, that he prepared himself prayer, gifts, and military. These are very popular methods in which nations would conduct themselves in strategy versus other nations. There would be diplomacy, there would be military strategy, there may or may not be a prayer session. But it seems that Yaakov Avinu is actually conducting himself in a very worldly way, in accordance with the way of society. And this is also a very important point in understanding the Torah. We live in a world. We live in a world of material existence. People go to work, earn money, support themselves. They interact with others. Sometimes they have conflicts, and those conflicts have to be dealt with. Sometimes it resorts to military ways. But of course, we also know that there is a watching eye and a guiding hand to every event, to all events of history. And that is the hand of God. And we know that God holds history and holds mankind in the palm of his hand like a chess player conducts the pieces. And at will, God can allow a certain plan to come to fruition, or he could stop it, he could thwart it. The most powerful king can have an intent of going to war and destroying, and God can wipe him away like he was a stick figure. And so there's really a conflict, it seems, in the world between man's endeavor, man's activities, and the powerlessness of man in the face of Hashem. How is one to conduct himself? And the truth is that the way Hashem wants us to conduct ourselves in this world is both, is to live in the world in accordance with what he calls the laws of nature, the order of nature, the order of things. That includes, plowing and planting and plowing and harvesting. Includes working. It includes possibly going to war. And we have to do that at the same time that we walk with God and that we believe in God's involvement in the situation, and that ultimately the outcome is in God's hands. This is a very, very difficult balancing act and a struggle that man has to face. What Rav Yerucham says is it takes a man like the caliber of Yaakov Avinu to be successful at this balance. We all have to strive for it, but it is so difficult to really do and to really be fully in both worlds. Yaakov Avinu did it. Yaakov Avinu, we will find throughout the Parsha, is extremely involved in as a statesman, all of the Avos, as a statesman, as a businessman, as a military figure, as an economist, and they were fully in touch with God's providence and intervention in their lives, but that for you and I, it's going to be a struggle. The moment we step too much to one side, we seem to lose our grip on the other. When we go to work, we seem to forget that our success and the results of our work is really a gift from God. How much we earn is not dependent by how much we work, or how clever we are, or how strategic we are. And when we don't earn what we think we should, it's because God decreed that's how much we will earn, that's how successful we will be. We seem to lose our grasp. When we go onto the other side and we say, everything's in God's hands, I'll just sit here and I'll just let God work his magic and work his wonders, then we are failing to live in the world the way God plans for us. He wanted us to be involved in the Teva because God does not want this world to be a world of open miracles. He wants it to be a place where awareness of God and also the hiddenness of God are both happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm. It takes a lifetime of work. It takes a great attitude like that of an Yaakov Avinu to be successful in this endeavor. All we can do is strive. We can learn from him. We can try to copy. We can try to study very, very closely. And we have to continuously study and contemplate. Prayer is a very big key to this. Making blessings, constantly being aware of God's presence is something that we have to do. But that it is a lifelong endeavor and a lifelong test. Yes, Mr. Mann.
Talk about his keeping all the mitzvahs, even though, of course, the Torah is not yet given.
Of course, what a good question.
Did he not marry sisters?
Yeah. Famous question. How could Yaakov Avinu say...
sin to be worried about?
How could he say that he kept all the mitzvahs when he married two sisters? That's one of the prohibitions of the Torah. Good question. Says in the Torah, you can't marry two sisters. Very good question.
I shouldn't have asked.
You probably want to know a good answer.
Yeah.
Well, one answer, I'll just tell you one answer, Nachmanides gives, is that the Torah was not given, and it was not commanded. The patriarchs, through their spiritual connection with God, were able to intuit, if you will, or understand what the Torah was saying, and therefore they did fulfill commandments. We have allusions to the fact that Abraham and Yitzchak were eating matzah on Pesach, even before there was an exodus from Egypt. But anyway, so yes, they did. The Ramban makes they said they had certain provisos. It's all voluntary. And one of the provisos was that only when they were in the land of Israel would they adhere to all of the commandments, but that when they were outside the land of Israel, they may not adhere to all of them. Apparently, there was a sufficient reason for Yaakov to unite with both Rachel and Leah that enabled this to be overridden. The Ramban does point out that may be very well the reason why Rachel dies on Yaakov's journey home before he made it back. Because once he crossed over into the border of Israel, he could no longer be married to the sisters, according to his acceptance. He accepted not to do that. And that's one of the reasons why Rachel died on the road. So what he's saying to Yaakov, what you're saying is you have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. When he said to Esav, according to Rashi, I kept 613 commandments, right, he meant whichever commandments I had accepted to keep. I didn't transgress. I didn't fall short of my commitment was. But that's a very good point. Yaakov.
Rachel was was the one who Yaakov originally intended to marry, then Yaakov and Rachel died.
That's a very good question. Yaakov's question is, according to what I just said, Rachel was the intended wife for Yaakov, and therefore it should have been Leah that died, not Rachel, because Leah was the second, was really the second wife in intent. But in practice, Leah was the first wife. The marital bond is established when you make the kiddushin, when you make the betrothal. And so since the kiddushin, it was Hashem's plan that he should marry Leah first, for whatever reason. So once that happened, Rachel was the second, not the first. Good question, though. Yeah, Steve.
Well, I understood was the primary concern he had was that he didn't have enough merit to, for God to fulfill his promise to him, because primarily he was with Laban for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during that 20-year time, he wasn't even in Israel. And he was not there, and in no way could he honor his father.
Not honoring his father.
And he knew that Esau was very, very powerful. That was his primary good trait.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Interesting. Steve is saying another explanation as to why Yaakov was so fearful. Because one of the great merits that Esav had was that he was excellent at honoring his father. His father, and especially his father. And Yaakov was particularly weak in that regard because he had lived away from his father for 20 years. So he was afraid that if he comes up against Esav and in heaven they're going to see, you know, see who should be victorious, they might give Esav the upper hand by virtue of this important mitzvah. And Yaakov felt lacking in that mitzvah. We know that Yaakov was punished for not communicating with his father for those 22 years, and that's how many years Yaakov was mourning for Yosef, thinking that Yosef had died. It was measure for measure. Because he had neglected to honor his father for those 22 years, therefore he lost the pleasure of knowing of his son's whereabouts for 22 years. That how fine is the judgment that God has of the righteous, too. Yeah. One more question, then we'll go on a little further.
When Yaakov first made the deal that he would work for 7 years for Rachel, did that not constitute any kind of commitment?
On Laban's part?
Well, on anybody's part, as far as, because I heard like with a betrothal, you know, that's like you're just about as much as married, you'd have to get a get in order to or something like a get to break that up.
Yeah.
So when he made that deal, isn't that kind of doing that?
Well, did they actually do a betrothal, or was it just like a verbal agreement? I heard that it was counted as a betrothal. If it would, then you'd have a good question. I think it was just a verbal. I thought it was just a verbal commitment with Lavan, which means about as much as a bottle cap.
Okay.
I guess for coming from Lavan. Yeah. It is a vow, but Lavan didn't feel bound by vows. He was not a man of his word. Okay. Chapter 32, verse 25. Let's go back a little bit. 23. Vayokam b'layla hu vayikach et shtey noshov yes shtey shiv chosov yes achad osar yilodov vayavor es mavar yabok. He got up that night and took his two wives, his two handmaids, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Yabok. It was a river. Vayikochem vayavirem es hanochal vayaver es asherlo. And when he took them and had them cross over the stream, he sent over his possessions. Vayivoser Yaakov levado vayavek ish imo adalos hashochar. Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. Famous story of the wrestling match between Yaakov and the Ish, the man. So, a few things. Why was he left alone? If he had brought his family over, and he had brought his possessions over, why was he left alone? So Yaakov's, Rashi says, Shachach pachim ketanim. The Chazar Alehem. He had forgotten a few small jars, and he went back to get them. he forgot, he brought over most of his possessions, but a few jars remained behind, and he needed those too. Now, that was an expensive return. It almost cost him his life. But Rashi adds the word, that's a quote from the Talmud, Mikan she'atzadikim chasim al mamonam shelo yishalchu yudehem bagezel. We see from here that the righteous are very careful, protective of their possessions, so that they should not, God forbid, have to take something that is stolen. They want to make sure they have everything that they own, so that they will have all of their needs, and they won't resort to stealing, God forbid. And Rav Yerucham gets all excited about this. What is the idea of going back for those small jars? And he basically builds up the theme that, again, righteous people see everything that they have as a gift from Hashem, and everything that Hashem gives them has a purpose, and it is to be used, and it is to be enjoyed. And to be lax or to be careless about possessions is being careless about a God-given gift. And we don't take that lightly. Whether it's money, whether it's a house, whether it's a car, or whether it's a few little jars. That again, this perspective that we spoke of earlier, the Yaakov possessed, the ability to live in the world, but to see everything in the light of the divine. Every small item, there's no such thing as anything insignificant, there's no such thing as just a jar. Because where did it come from? Who gave me the jar? Why did he give it to me? I'm supposed to use it and enjoy it. And if I don't, then I'm guilty of even if I don't resort to stealing, but I'm guilty of being careless with a God-given gift. And this, we could expand this to include our God-given talents as well. God gave us, blessed us with a mind, with a body, with individual, unique talents and intelligence. He wants us to use it. He wants us to make the most of it, and we have to guard it with preciously. Children, a great gift. And everything. We have to look around the world and see everything as a gift from God. Time, maybe the greatest gift of all. The gift of time is a gift from God. And if Yaakov did not take even the slightest jar lightly, then certainly we should not take our time and the gift of life lightly. Just to leave it at that. The second thing that we learn from this is this phrase by Yvaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov was left alone. You know, every word in the Torah is carefully chosen by God. By Yvaser Yaakov Levado, Yaakov was left alone. Rav Yerucham cites the Midrash that says that there's two people that are called Levado. Yaakov and Hashem. The word levado, alone. The niskav Hashem levado, as we say that in the Rosh Hashanah davening. The niskav Hashem levado. Hashem is exalted alone. He is unique. Hashem achad. Hashem is one. The one and only. Yaakov also is described as being unique, as being alone. Almost as if he has a godlike quality. Rav Yerucham says, absolutely. Man was created in the image of God, and we're commanded to emulate God. We are supposed to emulate God's midos, God's attributes. Why are we supposed to be kind? Because God is kind. We've spoken about that a lot. So in what way are we supposed to emulate God in his quality of being levado, of being alone? Alone really means independent. What the Torah is teaching us over here is that a man, in a certain way, of course, this has to be taken in with a great deal of context. But a man ultimately should emulate God in the area of independence. Sounds surprising. It sounds surprising to me, because whatever happened to having a friend, whatever happened to having a companion, a mate, whatever happened to living in a community, but a person can have all that and still strive to be independent. What this means is that a person should try not to depend on others for his success. An example, a beautiful example which Rav Yerucham gives. We're familiar with Pirkei Avos. It says, who is Ezehu Ashir? Who is wealthy? Hasameach Bechelko. He was happy with his lot, right? Well, let's say you define wealth the way society defines wealth. Wealth is defined as possessing a lot of capital, a lot of money, a lot of possessions. But people who are wealthy are very dependent on others. A person who's a wealthy business tycoon is dependent on his customers, on his stockholders. That person is really not independent. I know there's an expression, independently wealthy. But independently wealthy is not really real independence. If that person would ever lose his money, he probably would be suicidal. How much is he dependent on his money, and how much his money is dependent on others? Gibor, who is strong? So the typical definition of strong is somebody that has power over others. So his strength, he needs others. He needs others to make him powerful. If there's nobody to be powerful over, he's not powerful. What the sages are saying is that no, you can be independently wealthy, which means you can be wealthy by just being a master over what you have and by being satisfied. Your wealth is not dependent on anybody but yourself. You can be powerful by being a master of your passions and your desires, and by showing self-control. You're powerful without anybody else having to be there. You can be an honored person. You can be a man of honor, not when other people honor you, because then you depend on them. By honoring other people, this is an honorable person. This is all about independence. That's what it means. Vayivoser Yaakov levado. Yaakov remained alone. Yaakov emulated God in the ability to be independent. Not independent of God, but independent on relying on others. Doesn't mean, I don't mean to say that a person shouldn't live with others, because if a person doesn't live with others, then they can't do chesed, they cannot share with others, and then they wouldn't be emulating God. But I mean in the sense of, I can make myself independently wealthy, independently strong, independently wise. Again, who is wise?
Learns from others.
He who learns from others. Right? Not he who is, what would be the alternative explanation? He who knows more than others. He who can teach others, I guess, would be the common understanding. Once again, then you're dependent on others coming to you for your knowledge. If you set out to be a wise person because you learn from others, then you are independent. Okay, I'm going to do one more. 33:12. He finally meets up with Esav, and they have a dialogue. First Esav says, I don't need your present. Why don't you keep it? I've got plenty of stuff. Yaakov says, I have everything I need. Please take it from me. And finally, Esav took it. Then Esav offers to go with Yaakov. Verse 12, page 179. And he said, travel on and let us go. I will proceed alongside you. That's what Esav offered to Yaakov. And then Yaakov resisted the offer. He said, my Lord knows that the but he came up with like an excuse. The children are tender, the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. If they will be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at my slow pace according to the gate of the drove before me and the gate of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir. Esav persists. He says, well, at least let me assign to you some of the people who are with me. At least let me give you something, some help, assistance. Again, he says, to what purpose? Just let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes. I don't need anything from you. It's enough that you greeted me well. Please go on ahead. What's at the root of this conversation? Yaakov, please, let me help you. No, thank you. Go on ahead. Let me just help you a little bit. Please, I don't need anything from you. Says Rav Yerucham, this is also a great lesson and a great insight into the Jews' conduct in the world vis-a-vis his neighbors. We have to realize if we believe in God and if we believe in the Torah, we believe in the uniqueness of the Torah, we have to appreciate that things which we take for granted as values are not necessarily the same values in those that don't have this calling. A favor. What's the value of a favor? Somebody offers you a favor. Is he doing it because he has an obligation to act with chesed, because he's emulating God, which is the real purpose of chesed, or is it, you know, I'll do something for you, one day you'll do something for me. There's some ulterior motives involved. It could be, you know, in the worst case, it could be a trap. In the best case, it could be you owe him one, and who knows, you know, what that could mean. The proper posture, Yaakov Avinu is teaching us, the proper posture of a Jew is not to be beholden to others who do not share our values or our destiny, not to be beholden to them, not to be in a position where we must take from them and where we must thereby become in some way enslaved to them, ingratiated to them. This is something to stay away from. Sometimes it's unavoidable, but Yaakov Avinu is telling us this is part of a Jew's posture. You know, when it comes to a fellow Jew, we help each other out because this is our mitzvah. We are family. This is kosher. And even when we do so, we have an obligation of hakaras hatov, of paying back with gratitude. But when it's somebody who doesn't necessarily share our values and is not our brother in that sense, in terms of destiny, we must try to avoid it. We must try to avoid it because taking a favor is really taking a master. And this is something that you see from Yaakov. Everything in the story is not just a soap opera. He's showing us, he's teaching us great lessons, life lessons, both as individual Jews and as Jewish people. And we must look at every line, and every turn, and every statement, every gesture, as there to teach us something. We are blessed to have such great chachamim as Rav Yerucham and many, many others. We have to realize that the Torah is our living word of Hashem, and the stories are there to instill in us Jewish values and Jewish attitudes. Okay, questions?
Yes, Rabbi.
Yes, Jack, Steve.
If I read this correctly, Yaakov, because he represents Torah, is somewhat elevated above Abraham Yitzchak. If I read this correctly.
175, let's see. The Chafetz Chaim used to say, the evil inclination doesn't mind if a Jew fasts, prays, and gives charity all day long, provided he does not study Torah. Avraham represented kindness, Yitzchak represented service. Kindness and service are two of the three indispensable pillars of the world. For the third pillar, Torah, is the crucial one for Israel's success in carrying out its mission on earth. Jacob represented Torah, and without it, Israel will fail. This is why Satan did not confront Abraham and Yitzchak, only Yaakov. Jewish history bears this out all too tragically. In countries where Jews invested heroically in synagogues and charities, but not in institutions of Torah study, they assimilated and nearly disappeared. Only where they remained loyal to the legacy of Yaakov did they remain strong. Yeah, that's what he's saying. Now, we know that Yaakov only became Yaakov because he built upon the foundations of Abraham and Yitzchak. But in turn, and again, we said before that the Avos really possessed all three of their midos. But in the progression of things, Chesed, then Gevura, and then Truth or Torah, we have to realize that Torah is at the is the pillar, as it says on three things the world stands: Torah, Avoda, and Gemilas Chasadim. It says Torah first, then it says Avoda, which is prayer or service of God, and then it says Gemilas Chasadim. I was thinking, just this past week, I was talking with somebody about this Mishnah, the three pillars, and I said, if Torah is for Yaakov, Avoda is for Yitzchak, and Gemilas Chasadim is for Abraham, how come it's in the reverse order? But this is the answer. The answer is that in development, first came Chesed, then came Gevura, then came Emes, which is embodied in Torah, but in terms of the, and then now in terms of maintenance, in terms of upholding, granted we need all three. Cannot have Torah without Avoda and Gemilas Chasadim. Can't have truth without Chesed and Gevura, but Torah has to be number one. And from there will come the others. We wouldn't know about Chesed if not for Torah. We wouldn't know about the Midos if not for Torah. So Torah is the source. Therefore, when the Torah is under attack, that's the greatest danger. So, and the Satan tries to undermine Torah before undermining the other institutions. That's what the Chafetz Chaim was saying.
Shkoyach.
Baruch Tia. Have a good Shabbat, everybody. Yeah.
So we should have respect. Where is respect coming in with all this dispersion today?
With what? Where do we learn respect from?
Yes, is that from Torah?
Respecting whom?
Does the word respect come from Torah? Is that
yeah, kavod, yeah, kaved et avicha ve'et imecha, honor your father and your mother.
That's
Torah. The Aron was to be dressed in the special garments, the chavod ulasiferes, for respect. Now, the idea of respect in the Torah is not... It's not so that the person will receive the respect. The respect is an expression of what's important. You give respect, it's really for you, for the one who gives the respect.
Yeah.
He is able to demonstrate and convey his values.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of respecting parents is not so that the parents, not so much a reward for the parents. Like, I worked so hard raising you, now I deserve some respect. That's not really what the mitzvah of respect is all about. It's for the child to learn how important it is to honor the authority of parents and have gratitude for the parents, because he needs that in order to be a mensch.
Be able to tell his kids.
Honoring Torah scholars is not because the Torah scholars need the respect. It's because we have to show that we value their Torah wisdom, and that we want to learn from it. That's really what Kavod is all about, to convey one's own value.